What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal Point and Counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world, not forgetting current events that occur, plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah, Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
We welcome you into Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here in the Tribune Tower, Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. My name is Sam Panionovic, and there's plenty to get to per usual. We've got five guests today. We'll talk about a lawsuit involving Giants quarterback Eli Manning, possibly legalizing marijuana in Illinois, law school trends, and plus at the end of the show, the legal grab bag. But we began the show with Professor Deborah Denno. She's the Arthur A. McGivney Professor of Law and Founding Director of the Neuroscience and Law Center at Fordham University School of Law. And Professor joins us now in Chicago. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So breaking news this week involving the Arkansas Supreme Court. So yesterday afternoon, they stayed two executions that were scheduled for last night. There was an appeal then to the Supreme Court asking them to step in this morning without explaining it. Justice Alito denied considering the appeal, which means that the stay continues. Can you explain to us first, is this a trend that we're seeing nationwide, or is this limited to Arkansas? What are your thoughts on whether this is symptomatic of a bigger issue playing out across the country?
Well, on the one hand, it has been a bigger issue because we've seen lethal injection litigation be a reason for delaying executions throughout the country. On the other hand, the situation in Arkansas is unique. I mean, there hasn't been another state that's wanted to execute so many people in so little time.
And the explanation given by the state and specifically the governor for that is because they wanted to have eight executions in an 11-day window, which, as you mentioned, is a pace that's been unmatched in the modern era. The governor said, Asa Hutchinson said that this was necessary because of the fact that the drugs that the state uses in these executions are expiring at the end of the month and no replacement could be guaranteed because of an ongoing shortage. Is that a reason, in your opinion, to have such an unprecedented pace of executions?
No, I mean, that's a ridiculous reason to have such a pace of executions. This is because Arkansas simply is using this as an excuse to execute so many people so quickly, but it's certainly never been a reason to execute so quickly in the past for so many people. And usually the reason is this is justice, et cetera, but this is simply because the drug is expiring, and there's nothing under the Eighth Amendment or any other kind of constitutional doctrine that would find that acceptable.
All right. Is there another drug that's available? Or, you know, maybe you can educate us and walk us through the process a little bit. Why are they stuck using this one drug? Is there any alternative drug
on
the market?
I mean, there, you know, from 1977 to 2008, every state had very much the same lethal injection protocol. Starting in 2009, the starter drug, or that first drug, which is now midazolam, at least in Arkansas, started to dry up for reasons having nothing to do with lethal injection. Then states started going everywhere, scrambling for drugs, trying new drugs, and Arkansas eventually chose midazolam, but there's certainly other drugs to pick. They could pick a compounded pharmacy that would create pentobarbital, which other states have done. That's what Texas has done. There are other kinds of drugs that are available, and for whatever reason, and it's not a good reason, Arkansas hasn't gone in that direction.
So the Arkansas Attorney General, Leslie Rutledge, as well as the governor, have come out in the wake of this and said that they plan on proceeding with the five remaining scheduled executions, in their words, to bring justice to the families of the victims. These are, murders. One of them, for example, was someone who entered a home after finding a victim alone while her husband was away. and killing this woman in what they called an execution-style murder. Certainly the families are calling for these executions to take place. In your opinion, is the decline of executions the result of more attention to DNA, to exculpations, to, you know, situations like making a murder? Certainly that was something that has been widely seen, probably one of the most widely seen documentaries in history. Lots of people had an inside look into a murder trial, and at least according to the documentarians, pointed out all the flaws involved. So do you see those as being reasons why many states are veering away from executions?
I do. I think the public has been become increasingly aware of all the reasons why there have been so many problems with these death penalty cases as well as with the execution process. There's been a precipitous decline in executions since 1999. We had the lowest level of executions last year in 2016 than we've had since 1972 in this country. So because of education, because of reporting, the public has become increasingly aware, and we've seen these problems in Arkansas themselves, given that this no other state in modern history has tried to execute so many people in so little time.
All right, Professor, so where do you think the court will come down with the rest of these executions? Do you think that the Supreme Court will take up the case of the other five? Do you think they'll do the same thing they did with the two? And also, if you could comment on what you think of the current makeup of the Supreme Court with Justice Gorsuch on it as it relates to death penalty cases. I know that's a lot to chew off in one question.
Yes, of course. But that's okay. It's, you know, I think the state is going to continue to try to execute the remaining prisoners. Who knows how this is going to come out given the circumstances and given that midazolam is going to be expiring soon. That's number one. In terms of the United States Supreme Court, I mean, Justice Gorsuch has been on record as being pro-death penalty. He may look at the execution process as something quite different than being for or against the death penalty itself. This is a separate issue. Whether or not you're for or against the death penalty, you as a justice would certainly want the process to go the way it should under Eighth Amendment dictates.
That's Professor Deborah Denno from the Fordham University School of Law. We thank you so much for your time here on WGN.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Paperback writer.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can also find us on iTunes. It's Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. And now it's time to talk about the possibility of legalizing marijuana. And to do so, we bring in Representative Kelly Cassidy, who's a Democrat from the 14th District, and Amanda Vinicky from WTTW Chicago Tonight, and our official Legal Face-Off political correspondent. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Representative Cassidy, Illinois recently sanctioned marijuana for medicinal use. Last July, there was a law signed that decriminalized possession of small amounts of marijuana. You are now pushing for full-scale legalization. Tell us why.
The reality is I just think that it is time. You know, we've had this opportunity, not just here in Illinois with the medical program, but in states, you know, all over the country. We've got eight states with this program, with the tax and regulate structure in place. more set to come on in the year ahead. And the reality is the sky hasn't fallen. And in many cases, the outcomes have been even better, you know, in terms of, you know, not just the revenue that's available, but, you know, better ability to focus criminal justice resources where we really need them to be focused to make us safer, decreases in violent crime, you know, decreased access by youth, you know, the job growth and development and tourism potentials that these states have seen. It really runs the gamut.
And in terms of legalizing marijuana, I know other states have set a limit as the intoxication level. What would that be in Illinois? Is there a standard throughout the states that have addressed that, or is this something that still has to be addressed with the Illinois bill?
So actually, we addressed that in the Uniform Civil Enforcement Bill, the low-level possession bill that you referenced. We addressed that in that bill. We adopted the same standard that Colorado and Washington State both have, which is 5 nanograms per deciliter. It is, you know, the science is still developing. There's actually been studies that have suggested that that's still too low to detect the difference between intoxication and residual levels. But, you know, going with what's being used in other states was the desired outcome, so that's where we went with it. And, you know, ultimately, none of that changes, you know, evidence of impairment. So, you know, when you're weaving, when you're, you know, operating unsafely, and that's evidence of impairment, the blood levels aren't relevant. This is absent evidence of impairment, and this gives us a more logical standard. I think that the science is still developing. We saw that with 0.08. We moved that around for a little while, so we settled on what has become a pretty uniform standard around the country now.
Amanda, Illinois is facing an annual deficit of close to $10 billion. You're covering that extensively, almost on a daily basis. We're going on 2 years without a state budget. Springfield's a mess. Representative Cassidy and her partner on this project, State Senator Heather Steens, estimate that if Illinois legalizes cannabis, the state could generate between $350 million and $700 million in revenue that obviously is sorely needed for a variety of projects. What is the climate in Springfield currently for legalizing marijuana?
Well, a couple of points there. First of all, yes, clearly Illinois could use all and any money that it can get at this point in time, but even $700 million is a relative drop in the bucket when you're looking at this deficit of $10 billion. I mean, really, on an annual basis. We're not even getting into pensions there. That is just a deficit. So, yeah, Illinois could use the money. What you'll have critics counter is that for all of the money that Illinois would take in through taxing and legalizing marijuana, it would also cost the state more in terms of, again, this is just what critics would say, they do believe that it will lead to more accidents on the road, therefore more hospitalizations, also more addiction, whether you think of this as a gateway drug for children or just a gateway drug period in terms of leading to harsher drugs down the line. So that is the retort there. In terms of the political climate in Springfield and whether there is an appetite for this, I think that you have both Representative Cassidy and Senator Steens recognizing that there is clearly hesitancy, despite the fact that there was a recent poll from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute that showed voters don't particularly seem to mind. Overall, 2/3, I believe it was, of voters in this recent poll said that they at least support or even more so strongly support that legislation. Numbers go down when you look at older residents, and those are often those who vote. And just right now, in the lack of being able to have a budget.
There were no demographics that were below 50% in that age group. That's the thing that was most fascinating about it.
Yeah, I think the poll that you're referring to is, as you mentioned, the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute last month revealed that roughly 66% of Illinois residents support recreational marijuana, 30% are opposed. On a federal level, marijuana is still illegal. There's been conflicting messages coming out of the Trump administration Last month, Jeff Sessions, who's the U.S. Attorney General, said that he hopes to rekindle the war on drugs, including marijuana. Just this past Sunday, though, on Meet the Press, the National Security Advisor Kelly specifically addressed medical or marijuana and said that it's not a major issue. It's not something that they're going to be pursuing. So, Representative, how does that affect your decision making here locally?
Well, ultimately, you really laid it out. They have not made a clear statement, even from the beginning of the campaign. So we're moving forward, and as you said, we're not in a hurry to do this. This is a major public policy shift. We want to make sure that we do this in a thoughtful way, that we take lessons from other states that have done it, and craft our policy with that in mind. We would be the first state to do it legislatively. All the other states that have done it by referendum, which sort of hamstrings the state's ability to tinker with the program once it's up and running.
Is something that Illinois isn't really well placed to do. We don't have a state, unlike California, where you'll see referenda on the ballot, you know, maybe even a dozen at a time. Illinois' constitution isn't set up like that. So that's where that is an important difference in terms of how, if this is to be done, or perhaps when this is to be done, it will be presumably through a legislative effort such as this one. Sorry, Representative, go ahead.
And I will no problem at all. And I will say, we are having a hearing tomorrow, a joint hearing of the two appropriation committees that Senator Staines and I chair, and the director of the Colorado program is coming in. And one of the most telling things that she shared with us in an early conversation was the benefit of being able to do it legislatively and the ability to address unintended consequences. Because theirs is enshrined in their constitution. It was not written by lawmakers. It wasn't debated in a public forum in this way so that it could be tinkered with. It was put on the ballot, up or down, implemented immediately, no changes. And, you know, they've had some challenges around that. Some of those lessons that they've learned we've incorporated into our bill. But, you know, being able to do it legislatively in a way that we can continue to adapt and adjust and make it reflect our reality is a huge benefit. Heather and I are committed to having this fully fleshed out conversation so that people can make an informed decision about how to go about doing this. And I do think it's a when and not if. I really do.
Representative Cassie, how do you answer critics of legalization of recreational marijuana who cite links, studies between marijuana and opiates, who call marijuana a gateway drug, who, for example, people like the Illinois or groups like the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police have come out opposed to this, saying that there's no infrastructure in place. It's hard to police. There's no, for example, equivalent to a breathalyzer for marijuana. How do you answer critics who point to those things?
There are a lot of pieces there, so I'm going to try to hit all of them I can. The gateway thing, you know, the only gateway is the dealer who's going to upsell you. You know, when this product is available in a licensed and regulated facility where people are being carted, I have never seen it. I live in an area where, you know, we do have gang activity and drug activity, and I have never seen anybody ask anyone for identification when they're selling to them. So, you know, the reality of the studies that we've seen out of these states is that the worst case scenario is that usage rates don't change at all. Better case scenario in some of those studies is that use has actually dropped. In terms of the traffic studies, there's actually been little to no change in that as well. There's a pretty well debunked study that's getting waved around about, you know, massive driving issues. The data doesn't back it up. The data out of Colorado is that there wasn't a change in the rate of driving under the influence. And in fact, there was just a report released, I believe yesterday or today, that the numbers are actually dropping dramatically in terms of driving DUI marijuana charges in Colorado. So the data just doesn't back up the sky is falling argument. In terms of the police, the chief of police, you know, first of all, I'm not surprised. They tend to tack to the more conservative. You know, in the civil enforcement bill, we actually included a field sobriety test at the request of some members of law enforcement, of the prosecutors specifically. I don't know how widely used it is yet, but that was their desire to get another method of testing brought into play. And there's a saliva test available that can determine the level of THC in your system. And so that exists. It's on the market now. It's available. It's in our law. Like I said, at the request of the prosecutors 2 years ago, we put that in. So I think that the sky is falling, the Chicken Little approach is ultimately going to fail because the data just doesn't support all of these horrible outcomes. As I said, the data that we're seeing, the worst-case scenario is that things are pretty much the same.
Amanda, we'll let you wrap this up. If you have any final thoughts, you can put a ribbon on it for us.
I'll do my best to do that there. I do think that part of this will be obviously a gubernatorial election, maybe a year away, but already very much underway. It is clear that Republican Governor Bruce Rauner is at the very least hesitant about this notion. Therefore, that does, I think, change a bit the political equation. There are some of the Democrats that are running that are more in favor of this, and that perhaps would provide some cover, as well as what happens in Washington. You talked about the confusion with the Trump administration in terms of a drug policy or when it comes to cannabis, what the plans will be. But I think that is going to, of course, play a role in terms of what legislators decide. If Illinois were to be punished and take maybe another hit at the budget, you would see perhaps, especially Republicans, be more hesitant to sign on to this. It is clear, I think, also that Illinois' medical marijuana program is seeing a bit of an uptick in terms of patients who are taking advantage of it, as well as conditions, but nonetheless, there are nowhere near as many patients, in fact, double or about, I believe, even up to five times as more patients than the just over 1,800,000 that have signed up now are. That was expected to be a lot higher. And so that shows, I think, that while you had a very cutthroat competition for dispensaries and cultivation centers for this, they very much would be advantaged, presumably, by a recreational program. And right now their business model is struggling. So additional factors to look at.
That's Amanda Vinicky from WTTW Chicago Tonight. We also thank Representative Kelly Cassidy, state rep from the 14th District. Thank you both so much for your time here on WGN.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Moving along on Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. There's a lawsuit involving Giants quarterback Eli Manning. And to talk more about it, he's a partner at Clinton Brook & Peed. His name is Brian Brooks, and he joins us now on WGN. Hello, Brian.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good. So why are you suing Eli Manning and the Giants?
Well, the short answer is that there was memorabilia fraud going on. And what I'm talking about is saying that items were used in games like the Super Bowl when, in fact, they were not, and then selling them for money. And I represent three people who are the victims of that fraud.
So in your complaint, one of your plaintiffs alleged that he paid $4,300 for what was purported to be a game-worn helmet from the 2007 Super Bowl-winning season by the Giants. he called it a $4,000 paperweight. What other types of memorabilia is involved in this lawsuit?
Well, it's as far as what my clients purchased, it's helmets. But what we have information on is that there's also a number of fake Eli Manning jerseys that were out there in the world. And I think, remarkably, there's even fake jerseys that were given to Giants players like Michael Strahan. And just last week, Brandon Jacobs came out saying that he believes he was given a fake jersey by the Giants equipment staff.
Wow. So what you're saying is that the Giants were involved in that they were giving fake jerseys to their own players or former players?
Yep, that's right. And one of the reasons is likely because the equipment guys we're off selling the real things. And one of the people that I represent actually bought the real items. That's how we know that fakes were given to these players. And the players don't blame the collectors who are fans and were lied to about what was going on. They blame the equipment staff who was creating the fakes and lying to the players.
Sounds what, like, what? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, it sounds like that scene in Goodfellas, right, where all the good stuff's going out the back door while all the crap is staying up front. But, you know, what's the difference here in the terminology, Brian? Maybe you can walk us through it, because I think some people might have a misperception on what game used or game worn versus game issued is, and how they're differentiated.
Right. Well, game used means that it's actually something that was used during the game, during the gameplay. And typically, collectors are going to want to have it be item that was worn throughout the entire game so that they get, say, the helmet that Eli Manning wore during Super Bowl 46. And if it was not game used during gameplay, it could be called game. It was like a backup that was created to game specifications but was not actually used. And there is some debate as to whether if you just wear it during, say, pregame warm-ups, whether that would count as game used or game issued. But the consensus among everyone I've talked to is that that is still game used. And so it's a little bit of a gray area, but it's pretty black and white that if you don't wear it during the game or at least on game day, it's not game used.
Brian, what got a lot of attention, an email that purports to be from Eli Manning in which he asks the Giants equipment manager for two football helmets that could, quote, pass as game used. So you or one of the plaintiff's lawyers has uncovered an email that implicates Eli Manning. Is that part of it?
Sure. That is what you were just referring to there is an email that was recently produced in discovery by Eli Manning's attorneys. And until the Giants issued a press statement last week, we didn't know for sure whether the Giants actually had a copy or not. And they apparently are saying that they deleted it, but apparently at some point in time before they had a legal obligation to keep it. So that email, though, is consistent with an earlier email that we had that had been sent to my client by Joe Skiba, the Giants equipment manager, that said it essentially confirmed what he previously told my client, which is that Eli Manning was giving fake stuff to this memorabilia dealer, Steiner Sports, because he didn't want to give up the real stuff to Steiner. And an email from this guy's official Giants.com email address describes them as BS ones that were being sold. So we already had that. And then this email from Eli to Joe Skiba confirms what Joe Skiba had been saying, which is that Eli Manning was, in fact, personally responsible for this. At least that's what we will plan to argue. Obviously, I don't have personal knowledge of what was going on behind closed doors at the Giants Stadium.
And, Brian, who actually authenticates whether or not it's been, you know, game used or game ready? And would Eli have knowledge of whether these were used in a game?
That's a great question, and it's something that I think we will certainly be asking him when he gets deposed.
So, I mean, I'm just trying to wrap my head around that because it's pretty, you know, if that's true, that's a pretty huge, you know, admission. I mean, he's not admitting it, but that email is a huge smoking gun, right? I mean, we all know about emails allegedly in the Tom Brady Deflategate case involving their equipment managers. If Eli Manning, in fact, told the equipment people for the Giants that they should swap a fake in for a real helmet, I mean, that sort of destroys the squeaky clean image of Eli Manning, first and foremost. Sam is our host. He's also one of the foremost sports guys here in Chicago. How do you think this affects his legacy? I'll ask both Brian and Sam.
Go ahead, Brian.
I mean, for your purposes, you don't care about his legacy. I mean, it shows
right.
Culpability and liability in the damages case. But that's a huge smoking gun, right?
That's right. And I was going to say I'm not going to comment on what it does to Eli Manning's legacy. I'm not nearly big enough of a football fan myself to be able to comment on that. I will say this, though. What we had before was an admission from the equipment manager that this fraud was going on after the fact, calling what was done distributing BS ones. What this is not an admission. This is actually the act itself of telling someone to create or pass off something that was not game used as if it were game used. And so that is essentially a window into the fraudulent activities itself. And it is, I think, something that is it's not quite the smoking gun because we're looking at it in the process of, say, the gun being fired here.
Brian, not to name names, but if this happens in the Giants locker room, it has to happen in other places, too. That's my issue as a sports guy, because these athletes, they're all about the money. They're all about the green. And if this is going to happen to a guy like Eli Manning, I don't think the line stops there. I mean, would you agree?
I have heard rumors that it does go on elsewhere with even high, very famous quarterbacks elsewhere. But I don't want to comment on what happens in other locker rooms. All we are focused on is what was going on in the Giants locker room. And obviously it is completely unacceptable from a legal or moral or fan-based appreciation standpoint. Because ultimately, even though Eli Manning may have been giving the fake stuff to a memorabilia dealer that he had a contract with, at the end of the day, the victims here are the fans, and the biggest fans who are willing to invest the most money to get a piece of the Eli Manning history and legacy for themselves, and they were duped.
No doubt about it. That's Brian Brook. He's a partner at Clinton Brook & Peed, the website clintonbrook.com. They've got offices in Washington, D.C. and New York City. Thank you for your time here in Chicago.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Before we get to the legal grab bag, we have a return guest in studio. She is the DePaul University College of Law Dean, Jennifer Rosado-Perea, a return guest, but it's taken her a couple years to get back in. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Thank you so much. It's hard to get the dean in because she is so busy. I mean, I know the dean for many years, having worked with her at Northern Illinois University College of Law, and she is one of the busiest, most energetic people I know, so we're very privileged to get a few minutes of your time. Tell us about law school trends. What's going on? You're the dean of one of the foremost schools here in the area. One of the things that we talked about was, is it cool to go to law school again? Is it something that young people, even before millennials, whatever the current generation is called, is law school something that's attractive to this group of people?
Well, I'd like to think so. I hope so. And there's a couple trends that I think are helping it out. I think maybe the election of the new president is bringing a more positive light to law and lawyers, and I think that's great. And I think that law school, you know, even though we've been reeling for the last 6 years or so, we've really come back strong, and we're much better at teaching students, and we continue to be much more focused, much more experiential oriented, and really provide great futures for the students. And now they're not just practicing law. They're in business, they're in finance or in education, and law is a great degree for that. So we sell it as that as well.
Yeah, I mean, from our perspective, we talk all the time about how you don't need to become a lawyer with a law degree. I know that's something that you talk to a lot of prospective students about. Is that a trend that you see people getting a law degree but not necessarily practicing law?
Absolutely. And actually, that's one of the only growing fields right now. Everything else is either flat or a little bit down. But these, what they're called JD Advantage jobs, they're the ones that are growing in business, and where that skill set of a lawyer is really going to make a difference. And it's not shameful anymore. It used to be like second best. Now it's like, no, that's what I really want to do with my degree. And you just really, you know, rock those jobs in business because you bring that problem solving, bring that experience. And it's great.
Yeah. I mean, I always tell people, too, especially they'll ask us, you know, is it worth it? Should we do it? I think a law degree is great. Even if you don't become an attorney, it's great to at least get the critical thinking skills and, you know, learn how to analyze problems, and it can definitely be used in the corporate world.
Yeah.
What about the bar passage rate? That's always a hot topic. I remember being a law school student, petrified of how I was going to pass the bar exam or not. How's that doing?
Yeah, it's something that we've been adapting to along with all the other trends in legal education. The bar pass rates have been lowering over the last few years, and nobody really knows why. In Illinois, it was about 9%. It's lowered in the last 2 years, and so the question is, okay, why is that happening? But this bigger question is, why does it matter? Does it really relate to lawyer competence? So we're asking kind of a bigger question of what it means to be a capable lawyer, and law students or law schools are getting at the forefront and saying, okay, let's help you take the test, but let's help you be a competent lawyer. Both those things are important.
What are the economics of it? Certainly going to law school is expensive. Coming after spending some money on undergraduate degrees, how do you deal with the expense of becoming a lawyer as the dean of DePaul?
Yeah, I think that's always a key question. The value proposition of law school, we talk about a lot. But I think what's changed now, and the reality is that the law schools are really – you know, really competitive. And a lot of the students going to law school now actually are going for with a lot of scholarship money. And so it's a lot more worth it because the job market is opening up and they're not paying quite as much in terms of the sticker price. So it's a very worthwhile investment over time.
You mentioned the new president. What's the correlation that you see between Trump and people going to law school wanting to become lawyers, because we actually covered a story recently about how the Trump administration has the lowest percentage of cabinet members mm-hmm. and generally staff members who are lawyers. You know, on the one hand, Trump is probably the president who has employed the most lawyers in history in terms of his background, right? I mean, he mentioned in all of his books how, you know, lawsuits are one of the best ways to do business.
And he doesn't settle any lawsuits,
he doesn't
right?
settle.
Well, they just settled one, but he doesn't settle
the most sued president ever, the most prevalent user of lawyers. On the other hand, he's not using lawyers very much, and he's someone who said, I want to drain the swamp, and of course lawyers are, you know, perceived as part of that swamp. So what's the correlation that you see between Trump and law students?
Well, I think it's a bit reactive, although it's early to tell whether it's a correlation or a cause. But I think what we're seeing in the national news now is playing out is how important law is, how the balance of powers. I mean, we kind of just assumed it, but you know, now judges really matter, and they're being questioned in terms of their power. And I think law students are more activist, I think, than they used to be, and they're saying, I want to make a difference. How can I make a difference? So we're getting a lot of questions, for example, about our public interest program, about our immigration law clinic, because students feel like that may be a way for them to actually make a difference in the system rather than being in the streets and protesting and being part of the solution instead of part of the problem.
What I'm just curious, Dean, what is the cost of tuition now? Ever since Rich brought it up, I can't stop fixating on it.
It's about $45,000 a year. But like I said, a lot of our students are paying about, you know, 40%, you know, half, you know, some of them 50% or so. So it's at NIU and other public law schools, they really try to keep the cost down. So it's still pretty expensive. But now the value proposition, I think, is better.
Dean, you were generous enough recently to welcome in some students from my daughter's, my kid's school, local public school here in Chicago, for some lunch at the school, a visit with some students. And one thing I remember that you said was that law is everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, law is not just something you read in books or study. It's literally everywhere. And that's something, having hosted with Jason this show now for 2.5 years, that you don't realize that. You know, we sometimes struggle to come up with topics, but really not, because law is everywhere. It's really, you know, something that pervades your life in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. How does that affect your ability to attract quality law students and, you know, sell your law school to them?
Yeah, I think it does make it, if we can make that case as we try to when we bring students in from high schools and colleges, is that not only is law everywhere, that they can be a part of that law everywhere, that the law degree is one where you can have so many different paths. It's not like medical school, and you can change your path. So we really try to sell it as something that's very, you know, just everywhere, pervasive. And you can be a sports agent, you can be an attorney, you can be a teacher, and all of that will bring in your legal knowledge and make an impact. So I think it's huge.
What's the biggest challenge that you see to, talking locally here, Illinois law schools and the legal community in general? You know, we have a huge budget issue. We just talked to Amanda Vinicky and a state rep about the budget issues that we're having. You mentioned Northern Illinois. There's certainly some public schools in Illinois that have been very adversely affected by the budget crisis. You know, DePaul's in a little bit different situation, but do you see that as a huge obstacle to the legal community and law schools in particular, or are there other things that you're looking at?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One is the sustainability of law schools, because we're still very expensive, even with all the discounting and all that. We've got to figure out a way to be sustainable, to right size, and to be able to serve the students and allow them to be successful. I think access to justice, though, overall is a huge issue still. We still have, you know, there's a few percentage points of people can really afford a lawyer. There's the middle class that can barely afford a lawyer, and the poor who could in the past, but now with legal services being cut, I think that's going to continue to be a crisis, because we need, as we talked about, the system needs the legal system to be working and to be just and to be fair. And it's hard to do that if folks can't afford it.
You know, Rich and I have talked on the show, too, about you know, women involved in law, yeah. And that, and you noted that there's been more deans, more women that have been appointed deans of law school. And why do you think that is?
You know, my sarcastic or cynical view is it's not as attractive a job as it used to be in some sense. I think when we had a heyday of law schools where we had lots of money and lots of resources and lots of building, and it's a different kind of job now. I think it's a great job. It's very multifaceted. So there are different skill sets and perspectives that people can bring to the table, and women and men, you know, and people who are diverse can really bring that to the table. So there's more opportunities for women and others to come to the deanship and to bring a new skill set, a different kind of leadership skill set that can be very successful in these changing times.
Last question, we'll let you go on Legal Face-Off. Dean, I remember when I was in law school, it happened to be the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court nominee hearings, and I was, you know, the whole law school was fixated on it, as was the nation. I remember literally watching in the NIU Law Library the hearings on a mm-hmm. little portable TV. We just came off the Gorsuch hearings. Was that something that was heavily watched by students, or is it not as big a deal anymore as it was back in my day?
I didn't hear about much going on with watching it or being really vigilant, you know, being very interested in it. Although I think part of it is that students are on their laptops now. You're not going to get around in a student lounge. But I think folks probably thought it was more of a done deal and so listened casually, but it wasn't that kind of momentum. I think the next Supreme Court justice pick will be even more crucial. There will be a lot more people listening very closely.
Sure. Yeah, that's going to be, you know, a huge pick. It's going to be the swing vote. And now that they've established this precedent of, you know, 50 votes, Trump could really put in anyone he wants. I mean, and you know, the Democrats can't really do much about it. So I agree with you that that's going to be a huge pick.
The website is law.depaul.edu. Jennifer Rosado-Perea is the dean of the DePaul University College of Law. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks so
much. Dean.
Yep.
Thanks.
Legal Brad, back time on Legal Face-Off, WGN, Rich Lenkoff, Jason Whiteside. We've got seven topics, and we've changed things up at the top. We start with Rod Blagojevich, the former Illinois governor. His lawyers are saying that the government wants him to apologize for crimes that he didn't commit.
Yeah, breaking news. Who's got the breaking news sound effect, Craig? Breaking legal news on Legal Face-Off, even though this will be actually replayed like 7 days from now, thanks to the crack work of our team here. But this morning, Blago's lawyers were in court. Len Goodman, who we've had on the show a few times, was arguing yet again that Blago should be released early. He is currently 5 years into, a little more than 5 years into, a 14-year prison term in Colorado. And Goodman's argument today basically was that, again, that there is a difference between what Blago did, which was asking for a campaign donation, and a bribe. The government, according to Goodman's, is trying to say that there is no difference between those two, which Goodman and Blago's lawyers say is pretty unprecedented in the history of these kind of cases. We've covered this extensively. I don't think that the court will be persuaded for many reasons, including the fact that
it's the same judges.
Biggest
reason why it won't be.
Exactly. It's a three-person panel of judges who already have found that the sentence was reasonable. They can petition the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court already turned them down once, and they can, of course, hope for a pardon by President Trump at some point. On his way out of office, President Obama did not pardon Blagojevich. So the window continues to shut on Blagojevich's appellate chances, but today in court, his lawyers were trying to get him free again.
Legally speaking, I have tried to sell my seat on the show.
Yes.
Could I face repercussions in the future?
It's effing golden, your seat, just as the Obama Senate seat was.
Yeah, I think there's a slight difference between your seat and Blagojevich's seat.
Just a little.
I'm not even sure you could give that
seat away.
The
influence and the value. Yeah. Craig doesn't even want your seat. So.
Just try to run it up the flagpole, that's all. Yeah. You guys deal with workers' comp all the time. Representative Rodney Davis from Illinois, who's a Republican, is going after Jesse Jackson Jr., who's been collecting about $100,000 a year in workers' comp, and they're saying that this is wrong and needs to be changed.
Yeah, Jesse Jackson Jr. is becoming rivaling Trump in terms of stories here on Legal Face-Off. We covered last time, I believe, Jesse Jackson is receiving both disability and workers' comp benefits from the state of Illinois for some undisclosed medical conditions. One of them don't know about is post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, one was a congenital problem that he had too, right? That's right. Not caused by any of the external environmental issues.
Why should that matter, though, in workers' comp, right?
Jason? Oh, I know. This state's just rife with illegal claims.
So he's receiving workers' comp benefits. And one state rep, I think quite properly, has stated that they should change the law that, you know, someone who has been convicted of a crime, as Jesse Jackson has, should not be eligible to receive workers' comp benefits, especially for incredibly questionable, conditions like post-traumatic stress as it relates to someone who's, you know, been in Congress.
Well, I know there are some certain pensions, too. When you're convicted of a felon, you're not allowed to collect your pension anymore, especially, you know, certain police officers, too. So I don't know why they would allow a convicted felon to collect work comp benefits, especially when the condition arose while he was in prison.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. Jesse Jackson's also been in the news lately because last week it was disclosed that he offered to help the feds by disclosing other possible crimes by him and others. He offered to secretly record some others as part of a federal investigation. He served time in prison for fraud and for other conduct, but it was just disclosed this week that he offered to write out some of his other accomplices for some unknown other crimes. So who knows what else Jesse Jackson might be guilty of.
A judge of the New York Court of Appeals was found dead last Wednesday in the Hudson River after her husband had reported her missing.
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation. No one knows the real cause yet. They've said tentatively it was suicide, but yeah, Judge Sheila Abdus Salam of the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York, was found in the Hudson River floating, fully clothed. So they said that there's no reported signs of trauma on the judge's body. That's why they're thinking that it was a suicide. I think there's been some back and forth, too, over whether she was the first female African-American judge to serve or the first Muslim judge to serve, but reports say that she actually wasn't Muslim. First African-American judge, and unfortunately, it sounds like a suicide in the Hudson River.
Yeah, another judge who died, more local, Chicago judge, was shot fatally. Raymond Miles, 66 years old. He is a judge here in Chicago. He was very well known for being involved in the Jennifer Hudson.
He had two of the
Brown's chicken murders, yeah. The Jennifer Hudson murders. Some of her relatives were murdered. He was shot on the south side about 10 days ago, and they just in the last couple of days arrested the alleged getaway driver. It sounds like the judge was not shot because of his work as a judge. The police have called this a targeted robbery. Not the first time that this particular judge has been attacked. He was previously attacked in 2015 after a traffic accident. But in this case, the judge, unfortunately, was shot.
Yeah, and the traffic accident, too. This wasn't a minor thing. He was recording the damage, and he had his nose broke. He had to have reconstructive surgery to his face. So Judge Miles has been through quite a bit.
Did you ever appear before him? I don't know that.
No,
judge,
I never did. A criminal. He's down in the criminal court system. Yeah. I think he's over 26 in California is where he was at.
Former Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez, who was already serving a life sentence for murder back in the 2013 murder of Odin Lloyd. He was actually found not guilty of a double murder back in 2012, but he was found guilty of carrying a 38 caliber Smith & Wesson, and he got 4 to 5 years on top of the already
life sentence. So good luck. He'll be in prison for the remainder of his life. But, yeah, the prosecutors had a witness in Alexander Bradley who he himself was convicted of a drug offense, and he was the one that ID'd Aaron Hernandez as the shooter, but the jury didn't buy it. They basically got him, like Sam said, for carrying an unlawful 38 caliber Smith & Wesson revolver. But the defense attorney for Aaron Hernandez was not coincidentally the attorney for Casey Anthony. So Jose Baez scores another a pretty large profile victory for his client with Aaron Hernandez. Not that it's going to do him any good because he's still going to be put away for the remainder of his life.
All started from spilling a drink at a nightclub.
Yeah, stupid.
Aaron Hernandez was upset because someone spilled a drink on him and continued this altercation later into the night.
It was just two immigrants, too, who happened to be at the nightclub and you know, bumped into him and ended up shot to death. So
for those that know Hernandez, though, this should not be a surprise. There were instances when he was at Florida, and Urban Meyer knew this when he recruited him. When he was a freshman in Gainesville, he went into a bar and got into an argument with just another patron, took a beer bottle and smashed it along the side of somebody's head. He got into gun charges down there. I mean, he's just been skating.
Urban Meyer saw that and thought,
Didn't matter.
But can you catch the ball?
Yeah. Can you run?
You can run. What's your 40?
Now, this is a dumb question from the dumbest guy in the room. If you're already going down and you're facing a life sentence for murder, if you get charged with double murder, does that pick up, or does that just, how does that affect the sentence?
It's added on top of it, but it's irrelevant, really. I mean, this was more. This was more to ease the family of the victims and to put their mind at ease. And, you know, even if they found him guilty, supposedly the family would feel some sort of relief. They didn't. So, I mean, it's really, it's immaterial what they sentenced him with if he was found guilty.
And they show him in the courtroom, like, hugging his attorney, but you still have to go back
to
jail.
Well, no, yeah, right behind him are the deputies who are going to put the cuffs right back on him and bring him back to prison. So,
and it also depends on whether the judge does have some room to sentence someone to concurrent or consecutive terms. Concurrent means they're served at the same time, but those are generally for the same crime. Because this was two different crimes, it's unlikely that the judge would sentence him concurrently. But the biggest takeaway, I think, is it gives a whole new meaning to the word tight end as it relates to Hernandez's prison term. You with me on that, or? No?
Yeah.
Let's move from murder to divorce. How about that?
Yes.
Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner in their divorce filing.
Benifer,
right?
It has
to be the nicest divorce that's ever gone on.
Really unusual, though.
Yeah. So, I mean, the unusual part is that this couple who filed last week in Los Angeles, they filed Thursday, they filed without lawyers, which, you know, we don't like as lawyers. But they filed what's called in pro persona, which is a legal term that means that they are representing themselves. They didn't have a lawyer representing them. Now, this is unusual for many reasons, the most obvious being that this is an incredibly high-profile case, lots of marital assets to deal with, and the fact that no attorneys are on the filing is unusual. But there will be attorneys involved. A lot of times they do this simply for PR reasons to make it look like it's amicable. The most important part of this, though, is the fact that they did not specify a separation date. That's really important in California law because that is the date that is the cutoff for community property. California is a community property state, which means that the marital assets are divided in half. But that is based on when the separation occurs. So very interesting that they didn't put a separation date in there.
And she hasn't been in, like, any movies recently. She's been in, like, the Capital One commercials, right?
Well, I think she's Capital One commercials make bank, though. I mean, those are
Jennifer Garner. Yeah, I mean, it's not that they don't have attorneys. They just, the way they file the documents, they want to help, you know, keep it protected and sealed, too. They could still have attorneys, but they've been working on it for 2 years now, so.
Favorite Ben Affleck movie, Sam? Is there such a, mine is easy. The Town, I think, is one of the, best movies in the last, 10 years.
Good Will Hunting?
You know what was really good? Yeah. I thought The Accountant was really good. I thought it was
haven't seen it yet.
It was a good movie.
Good. Craig Collins, favorite Ben Affleck movie?
He likes Giglio or Giglio. Giglio.
Of course.
Batman.
How
do thumbs up.
How do we feel about the Batman, Ben Affleck as Batman?
Awful,
no?
Batman.
Hate it?
No, not a good Batman.
I didn't like the Batman and Superman. I don't know. But I'm not big into the comic books. I think people that like the comic books probably like the story.
The Town was awesome, though.
That was.
Very good movie.
Underrated movie.
Underrated indeed. Last story on the grab bag before we wrap things up here. Gordon Ramsay, the famous chef, his father-in-law admits to hacking into Ramsay's computer to find a picture of his lover.
Yeah, Chris Hutchinson was partners with Gordon Ramsay, is also his father-in-law, and was terminated at some point in 2010 due to, some business dealings. And Hutchinson hired someone to hack into Gordon Ramsay's computer to see if Gordon Ramsay had evidence of Hutchinson's girlfriend on his computer.
Is this the most dysfunctional family in history?
Well, and it was over 200 attempts to get into the computer, and they were able to trace the IP address directly back to Mr. Hutchinson.
And the sons are involved, too, somehow, right?
Yeah, the two sons were involved, too. No, there's over 2,000
There's a second
attempts.
Wife, and there's
So it's divided the family. Ramsay's wife, whose father was the one that did this, is basically disowned the entire family and stuck with Gordon Ramsay.
No wonder Gordon Ramsay has 18 different shows. He's got to pay for all this family stuff.
All his family trying to steal from him.
Do you watch the the Gordon Ramsay show, Sam?
I've seen clips. There was
donkey! He loves screaming, donkey!
And F off. Yeah. Like, F off is his favorite thing to yell.
Those restaurants are expensive, though. I've been to, he's got a couple, like...
We're out in L.A.?
Yeah, in L.A.
What are they,
London, like those, I think, is one. It's just ridiculously, like, you know, like fancy.
It's like $500 a person for a nibble.
Yeah, there's a couple in Vegas, but...
You should get them on the show.
Yeah. Donkey!
Anything I may have missed? Anything? Closing?
While you were away the last month? I don't know.
Let's see what we covered in the last seven episodes.
Yeah, okay. I meant on this show, but...
Blackhawks!
Yeah.
Yeah, what's
Sam,
going on?
What's the...
In trouble. Old and slow. Old and slow.
Let me ask you this question.
Really?
Quenville's untouchable, obviously, but any other coach, objectively, with this team losing 2 years in a row, first round, gone.
Could
right?
be waxed.
I mean, gone.
But when you have,
Quenville's
three,
untouchable.
You have three rings...
At what point does, like, Quenville have to look over his shoulder?
I mean, I think Stan Bowman is more to blame.
Bowman's the MVP of this team, though. I mean, before this, the moves looked unbelievable, right? But, I mean, I guess you got to look to Bowman, but it's the players, I think. They are old and slow. Taves is, like, invisible the last 11 games.
Well, I meant more so
games.
Keith and Seabrook and Oduya.
Those guys
has
are,
been awful.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Maybe they'll rattle off four in a row.
Maybe.
Maybe they will.
Go Habs.
Yeah.
Go Canadians.
I disagree with that. For Rich and Jason, I'm Sam. For anything you may have missed, WGNRadio.com. Thanks to Craig Collins as well. We'll see you in a couple of weeks on Legal Face-Off.